Welcome to If Then, the show about how technology is changing our lives and our future. I'm April Glazer.
And I'm Will Oremus.
Today we'll discuss a rather terrifying security flaw from Apple, a company that prides itself on keeping information well protected. A bug was found in the video chat app FaceTime that lets snoops listen in on someone by calling them on FaceTime even if the call wasn't answered.
Then we'll be joined by Franklin Foer. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic, former editor-in-chief of The New Republic, and author of a book about what he calls the existential threat of big tech. We'll talk to him about the recent wave of layoffs in the media, including big cuts at BuzzFeed, HuffPost, and Gannett newspapers, and how those tie into the dominance of companies like Google and Facebook over the way we get information now.
And as always, we'll end with Don't Close My Tabs, some of the best things we saw on the web this week. That's all coming up on If Then.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
All right, April, good to see you. I saw that you have continued reporting on PG&E's woes out in California lately.
Yeah, last night the board decided to go ahead and file for bankruptcy, which means that the interests of the creditors to the company are going to be prioritized over those of the fire victims and the ratepayers. And, you know, as the debt is consolidated in bankruptcy court, we could, you know, see much longer wait times for people to, you know, get any sort of, you know, justice or money back and perhaps even lower settlements for people who are still awaiting kind of getting some sort of money from the fact that they lost their homes and loved ones and so much more. So a major story, just to note, PG&E serves 16 million people, right? So like two New Yorks, and is saying that it's about $50 billion in debt that it's unable to really account for. So we'll see what happens from this, but it could be devastating for Californians, for sure.
Yeah, and a story that's not really being covered on a national level quite the way you might expect. So I'm glad you've kept on that.
Yeah. I think there's an interminable amount of reporting from California and the energy crisis here. But Will, what have you been kind of focusing on over the past week or so?
What I was looking at today was a really nasty bug in Apple's FaceTime app.
Yeah. So this happened last night. I saw people were really seemed rightfully kind of freaked out about it because it seemed pretty ubiquitous. What exactly was the bug or is the bug?
All right. So here's how it worked. I call you on FaceTime. Mm-hmm. And before you answer, I add my own number to the call to make it a 3-way call. And I patch myself in as the third party. Then before you even pick up the call, I can listen. I immediately can start listening through the microphone on your phone or your laptop. And the crazy part is if you then went and you saw it ringing, maybe you're doing something else, so you hit the volume down button, which makes the ringing stop, that would actually activate your video camera, and then I could be looking through your camera at you without your knowledge. And it would stop only when the call timed out. I would lose that access. So we don't know if hackers actually exploited this for nefarious purposes, but they certainly could have. And we learned today that this was actually discovered by a 14-year-old playing Fortnite a couple weeks ago. And his mother tried to help him alert Apple about it for a week before they finally broke through. It ended up being widely reported on Monday night, and by early Tuesday morning, Apple had just shut down three-way calling, or group FaceTime, as it's called, while they're working on a more permanent fix to the bug.
And so this is coming after we learned about kind of a downturn in iPhone sales, and also the company's quarterly earnings are supposed to be released soon, right?
Yeah, it came right ahead of the earnings report. So I don't think we'll see any impact there, but it's fair to assume we'll get some questions from investors. To me, the takeaway here is, you know, Apple is a company that has really tried to orient itself lately around protecting its users' privacy. We talked about how it put up a big billboard at CES, the annual tech conference in Las Vegas, saying what happens on your iPhone stays on your iPhone. So even a company that is prioritizing privacy, you still can't fully trust it. And in some ways, it could actually be, you know, there could actually be more danger to the average person from Apple products and services than from, say, Facebook, because by now I think there's a broad public awareness that you shouldn't post stuff or put stuff in Facebook that, you know, is really sensitive. But for a lot of us, people who use Apple products loyally, our laptop or our iPhone, you know, we take it everywhere. We give it intimate access to our lives, and we trust Apple. And this is just a good reminder that, you know, if you're giving up that kind of data, if you're giving that kind of access, if you have a camera in your pocket and a microphone in your pocket and a smart speaker in your living room and a camera on your laptop, that there will be things that go wrong inevitably, even among companies that are doing their best to prevent it.
Yeah, you know, we really have always kind of propped Apple up as the, you know, privacy pioneers and really stewards of good examples of keeping data safe, because they're not as much in the attention economy as everyone else. But you're right. Essentially, these are networked devices that we carry with us everywhere, and we trust to kind of be a conduit to the most sensitive conversations of our lives. And we don't know how bad this this was, and we don't know how it was used improperly exactly yet. And it's a lot of trust that we kind of give to these companies that somewhat time and time again show that maybe we shouldn't trust them so much. We don't really have a choice. And I mean, to be fair, Apple has been, you know, relatively, seems like, very privacy conscious. And this is a bug, you know, something that of course they didn't intend to have in the iPhone.
Right. And I think if you're looking for one small takeaway, I mean, it could just be overwhelming and depressing to think that we never have any privacy anywhere and there's nothing we can do about it. If you're looking for one small takeaway, the people who put a little bit of tape over their laptop camera can probably feel a little bit vindicated today. The idea being that you don't want somebody to be able to take over your camera without your knowledge and be spying on you through it. I actually use a little bit of painter's tape, which is nice because it doesn't leave residue. You can just stick it on or take it back off. It's one small step. It probably won't save you, but if you want to feel like you're doing something, it's not the worst idea.
Next, we'll have our interview with Franklin Foer from The Atlantic to talk about job cuts at BuzzFeed and the greater media landscape under the influence of mega tech companies.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Our guest today is Franklin Foer. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic. He's the former editor-in-chief of The New Republic, and he's the author of the recent book World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. Franklin, welcome to If Then.
Great to be here.
The news this week is that digital media outlets and print media outlets have been laying people off, laying off journalists. So BuzzFeed laid off 15% of its staff. HuffPost laid off 7% of its staff. Gannett is laying off reporters at papers across the country. How does that tie in to this knowledge monopoly that you see companies like Google and Facebook acquiring and maintaining?
Well, I think BuzzFeed is probably the best example that we should really zoom in on, because in so many ways it is the quintessential media company of the Facebook era, that when it was created by Jonah Peretti in, you know, more than 10 years ago, the business model for the company was all about creating content that would go viral. Peretti, of course, was studied at the MIT Media Lab, where he became obsessed with the concept of what makes something go viral. And then he'd worked at Huffington Post, and he saw the emergence of social networks and wanted to create a business that could exploit the power of the networks to produce content that would become wildly viral. I think as time has gone on, it's clear that instead of mastering the platform, BuzzFeed in some ways was kind of mastered by the platform. And so at first, BuzzFeed thought that it wouldn't have to rely on Facebook for advertising revenue, because so much of its advertising revenue was going to come through what's called native advertising, where they were working with firms and brands to specifically design advertising that was embedded in BuzzFeed's site. And that was a little bit confusing to identify, but that model didn't really work. And so then started to try to sell the same sort of digital advertising that Slate or the Washington Post or Vox sells. But the problem is that in that world of digital advertising, there's just no beating the platforms. That a company like Facebook or Google both has more data than BuzzFeed or any other media company has, and therefore can identify audiences better. But also, just given their scale and the volume of advertising that they have, they can constantly undercut their competitors in the marketplace. They can always sell advertising cheaper because they just have so many damn eyeballs. And so we've emerged in this world where Facebook and Google have become this duopoly where they control over 70% of the advertising market, and it's simply become hard for anybody else to compete. And the tragedy of BuzzFeed is that they, in some ways, represented media's best hope. That they were the company that best mastered this new era, that had the best technology, the best digital savvy. And yet, as we've seen from these layoffs, they couldn't hack it on the scale that they initially planned.
When we're all using the same conduit to reach readers or listener subscribers or whatever, I guess readers in this case, we all start publishing the same thing. And, you know, even though maybe more people are reading than ever, we have all this free content, we're actually all kind of telling the same story over and over again. It's a demise of localism, but it's also a homogenization of content. And I'm wondering if you could speak to that.
Yeah, it's one of the ultimate ironies of the internet, which is supposed to be this nichified, highly customized, personalized space where you get what you want, you find your little communities.
Right.
And yet, the incentive structure for media in a world governed by Facebook and Google is to produce to this kind of lowest common denominator. And really, I think the key term of our era is trending.
Yes.
That we all try to produce things that are on a subject that's at the trailhead of its ascent to popularity. And we're all trying to kind of scrape traffic from precisely the same subjects. And part of this is the tyranny of data and the way in which we allow data to dictate the judgments of the industry. But it's also, as I think you're suggesting, it's just embedded in this world where we're all trying to, we all view traffic as something that we can glean from the platforms. And so then we're playing by the platform's rules. And the platforms are pushing us in a certain direction towards the same conversation.
Right. And so the fact that we now get our news largely from Google and from Facebook instead of opening the newspaper that's on our doorstep or subscribing to print magazines or even going to visit a particular website means that, for a while people thought that if you could just game these algorithms, then that was the way to succeed. And as you said, that's exactly what BuzzFeed did. They did it better than anybody else. And now even BuzzFeed is finding that it can't support quite the kind of journalistic enterprise that it thought on this advertising economy. So where does that leave us? I mean, you know, clearly Facebook and Google are, consumers choose to go there. People choose to go there to find their news. I don't know that you can stop them from doing that because they bring together all these different sources that appeal to you. On the other hand, their model seems to be predicated on the fact that they don't have to actually pay to create this content, right? I mean, fundamental to being a tech company is that you're not the one paying huge teams of humans to produce the content. You're just aggregating it.
I mean, I think that you said that it wouldn't be possible to stop people from relying on Facebook and Google as primary portals. And I think that we're in the relatively early stages of a pretty tremendous backlash against Facebook. It's a bit of a cultural revolution, a countercultural revolution, where I think that there's this broad sense that the media environment has gotten drecky, that Facebook played this role in the election of Donald Trump and the spread of misinformation, and that it's an environment where we're all subjected to tremendous amounts of manipulation. And you do see users, at least, I mean, at an elite level, I think, starting to talk about retreating. And I think that its cultural prestige, at the very least, has plummeted over the course of this, which suggests that maybe we can make ourselves less dependent on the platform. Not that I think that this is just a consumer issue, which I emphatically do not. But I do think that as consumers, we do make choices, and if we don't like this environment, this ecosystem, we can make a series of personal ethical changes about how we interact with it. So then I do think that there are policy questions that we for generations we were sleeping on the questions about corporate bigness, and you do see antitrust returning as a topic that's not just a fringe lefty area of conversation. I think it'll be an important issue in the next presidential campaign. I'm sure you saw Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's tweets over the weekend about the peril of big tech and the threat that it specifically represents to media. And I think it's really telling that she used the phrase that she said it was one of the most important issues that we face. And so I do think that that is evidence of a zeitgeist that's headed in a direction where you have people talking about breaking up these companies into smaller pieces. So, and I think one of the areas that you would see antitrust potentially go straight after is this advertising monopoly.
With journalism, though, it seems that there might always be a funding struggle unless there is just like a rich magnate that wants to forward, their agenda or wants to put money behind something because they believe it's in the public interest. And I'm curious what you think about the idea of there being some sort of 1% tax or endowment or something that kind of big internet companies have to pay. This is something that I've heard some people float. I think Emily Bell had some version of this, but to fund journalism, a way to kind of make sure that there's always money for this public good.
It's hard in that the United States doesn't have a tradition of government subsidizing media, at least not one that we can call upon that's part of our immediate memory. But in fact, so as somebody who actually edited a print magazine, we were subsidized by the U.S. government. We sent things through the U.S. mail,
right?
And there was a postal rate that gave us a comparative advantage on other media. And that was something that the founders and that the early republic really focused on as a way of making sure that information served this purpose that you just described. I am not adverse to thinking about a model where, we have a National Endowment for the Humanities. We have a National Institute of Health. We have examples where government subsidizes activities that the market, where there's some sort of market failure, and they actually work pretty well. I mean, I they're small scale, but the National Endowment for the Humanities or NIH fill gaps. They yield pretty good results, and we're squeamish about that, and understandably so. When Donald Trump is president of the United States, it's kind of hard to imagine wanting to have the government have take a deeper role in journalism. But as we confront this crisis, I think it's important to have a sense of imagination. And you know, the fact that there's the possibility of Trump meddling in something like this doesn't mean that it would actually turn out that way. I don't think he meddles with any evidence of meddling, him meddling with the National Endowment for the Humanities or NIH or any of these other structures. You can find ways to insulate them. And if you have a president who's messing around with well-insulated institutions like that, well, then you're already in an authoritarian era.
You know, you mentioned earlier that we haven't really seen effective antitrust action from, you know, U.S. policymakers in some time. I think it's been over 20 years since Microsoft. And, you know, Certainly there's a flavor for that amongst our elected officials, but I'm not necessarily seeing any sort of like actionable proposals coming from them, nor am I, or like things that will really concretely they can pile on behind, nor am I seeing the FTC really willing to do that, at least under Trump. You know, there's definitely been some comments and some things that we can get excited about. And so I'm curious, like, I do think that eventually, maybe one day, I hope we can see some sort of antitrust action, but I'm worried that it's going to be too late.
Yeah,
I'm worried that it's going to happen when the industry is already gutted and there's not much left to save. And that's kind of why I'm interested also in this endowment idea, because like, maybe we're going to need both, right? Maybe we're going to need to break up the power and fund it something new. But you know, once something is gone, it's really hard to resurrect it. It's hard to undo things. It's, you know, so I'm worried about timing.
The Facebook Local News Initiative, I think, will be an interesting test where you could pour $300 million into local news and probably still get nothing, because once those institutions are gone, they do become harder to reinvent. So there are a couple problems. One is that over time, our notions, our understanding of antitrust has morphed. And so starting in the 60s, you had the Bork revolution in antitrust, where once upon a time, antitrust was concerned with corporate bigness and saw bigness as inherently threatening. And then when Bork shifted us to this model where we only started to worry about bigness when prices got jacked up and everything became about the welfare of the consumer, we took this several decade dangerously wrong turn, and it's hard to zigzag back in the other direction. And so the idea of acting quickly against these companies, I think, requires us overcoming about 50 years of bad jurisprudence, bad regulatory practice, and it's going to be hard to correct that fairly quickly. I think that the best approach is probably an all of the above approach. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you guys have talked to Mark Warner, but his white paper that he published last summer, I thought was the best attempt that I've seen by a politician to wrestle with these questions. And I thought he was a little squeamish about antitrust, but he had about 10 different solutions that he proposed, all of which were interesting, all of which could make a difference, none of which on their own would be sufficient.
It is interesting that news recently came out of Facebook that it's looking at consolidating or more deeply integrating Facebook proper with its other properties, Instagram and WhatsApp. And a lot of people, I think, rightly interpreted that partly as an anticipation of potential antitrust action, right? Like if they can weave WhatsApp and Instagram and Facebook together, they're going to be that much harder to split apart. I'm not entirely optimistic about antitrust taking on big tech in a way that ends up being meaningful for the media, partly because I think there's like a natural monopoly force at work where I think no matter what you do to Google or Facebook, there will be a desire for a lot of people to open one feed and see stuff from all their friends and see, you know, or open one website and be able to search for news stories. I feel like that's not going to go away. That's my bias, that there will always be portals that aggregate the news. But given that that's the case currently, at least, what would you do if you were starting a media outlet today? If you were going to run a media outlet, what would be your business model? I'm assuming it would not be trying to get as many eyeballs as possible on Facebook and then convert those into money via pennies on the dollar digital advertisements.
Yeah, as you correctly guessed, I'm not a viral guy. I signed up yesterday for a newsletter that a journalist from Wired started who was covering Amazon. I gave him $50 for him to produce this newsletter that's going to be a really detailed look on about Amazon. And I think that we've just been seduced by delusions of scale in our business, and we never used to have those before. And I do think that I would do something that would be fairly, that would have a clear audience that's not the entire world, that I could speak to in a way that builds a sense of affinity and that is deemed as a commodity that's worth paying for. One of the flaws in the BuzzFeed model is that as it tried to be everything, we've heard all these announcements about these desks and bureaus, and the Mexico bureau got shut down, the
national security team, national desk, health team. Yeah.
It was such a vast, sprawling thing, and it was actually a very unfocused organization, even more unfocused than, say, probably than the New York Times, in the way that it kind of organically sprawled without any disciplining mechanism. But I think niche is what people will increasingly turn to, and trying to build up this deeper sense of relationship, which unfortunately I think will require us probably downscaling even more. Because if your goal is 80,000 subscribers who pay you a good chunk of change every year, how many reporters can you sustain with that kind of revenue model? Not that many.
Franklin Forrest, thanks so much for joining us on If Then.
Thanks, guys.
One final quick break, and then don't close my tabs. Some of the best things we saw online this week.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
What is the one most important thing our society needs?
That would be harsher punishment for parole violators, Stan. And world peace.
Okay, we get it. World peace might seem like a pipe dream. But what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world. And in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
It's time for Don't Close My Tabs. Will, what tab could you not shut this week?
All right. For once, this is a long story that I actually did finish. And it was because it was such a gripping read, although in kind of a weird way. This was an essay from Wired, and the headline was a little misleading to me. The headline is Big Tech Merging with Big Brother? Kinda Looks Like It. That's like the kind of casual tone where I would expect a short blog post. I would have missed this, actually, if someone hadn't flagged it on Twitter as like, this is amazing, you have to read this, what a wild essay. I was like, okay, really? So I read it, and this person was exactly right. It's by David Samuels, who is a freelance writer, I guess, is a contributor to New York Times Magazine, N Plus One, is the literary editor at Tablet. He takes you on this whirlwind tour of the history of philosophy and science fiction and speculative fiction to put our sort of present tech moment in perspective. He's looking at all the big works through history that have focused on the idea of machine intelligence and on questions of whether the information in society is controlled by some central authority or whether there's free expression. He sees in Google and Facebook powers that are increasingly regulating what we can say and have sort of veto power over what gets said and by whom. He also ties in the social credit system in China, where sort of everything you say or do online goes into building a score that will then determine your access to government benefits and how you get treated in various settings in society. So it's really, you got to like sit back and like brew some tea and be ready to mull over it for a while. I didn't find it entirely coherent, but it's really fascinating.
I don't need coherence essays.
And maybe best as a bibliography, just a reading list of amazing stuff that you should
review.
Go back and read for a historical perspective. Yeah.
No, you know, intellectual history is super important to trace back. It's something that I think a lot about when I think about kind of why companies are inactive or unable to consider themselves responsible for certain things that we all have to live with every day.
But yeah, so that's my tab this week. April, what about yours?
Okay, so it is a story that just came out while we are recording here on our local station. I know I'm always giving like Bay Area news. I'm sorry if our listeners are all over the place and don't care about the Bay Area, but it's a really important spot with a ton of billionaires that kind of control all of the world's information or our access to it. And today that was really put into stark relief with the fact that Pandora officially is now going to be acquired by satellite radio company Sirius XM for $3.5 billion. Pandora is based in Oakland. And, you know, this was announced in September, and I wrote about it back then. The thing is that Pandora and Sirius are actually owned by a company called Liberty Media.
I had no idea, by the way.
Yeah. And so Liberty Media has given millions to Trump and political action committees of the GOP, and as well as executives from the company. And so this merger is also important because it's not just Pandora and Sirius, which we have to realize are one of the biggest streaming companies and the biggest digital radio and satellite radio companies, but also the CEO of Liberty is the chairman of the board and has significant stake in Live Nation, which acquired Ticketmaster in 2010. So this is a major music monopoly. And it is kind of a tech story in a way, because we're talking about kind of the gatekeeping to how we consume art and music and kind of when we see consolidation on that front, we often see homogenization. And the interests of those companies are apparently politically deep within the interest or aligned with the interest of President Trump. So really important story to watch as we kind of continue to see consolidation from tech companies, or at least like tech platforms kind of infiltrate every aspect of how we consume media, and, you know, thinking how that's affecting the music industry. We're talking about how we get tickets, the venues that we see musicians in, the avenues through which we listen when we're not seeing them live, all consolidated kind of under the same Trump donor. So that's something I'm going to keep watching for sure. As somebody who's kind of, you know, grew up and loves the music industry, I kind of grew up in it, so.
All right, a good tab. And that is our show for this week. You can get updates about what's coming up next by following us on Twitter at IfThenPod.
You can also email us at ifthen@slate.com. Send us your tech questions, your gripes, what you love about us, and we'll see them and maybe get back to you, maybe not, but we'll definitely see them. Really appreciate everyone that emails us when they do.
You can also tweet at us, by the way, at ifthenpod. I realize we don't always do the greatest job of updating you on what's coming up next, but we do read that as well. We read the replies. You can follow me and April on Twitter as well. I'm at Will Arimus. April is at April Laser.
Thanks again to our guest, Franklin Foer. You can find him on Twitter at Franklin Foer. F-O-E-R is his last name. And thanks to everyone who left us a comment or review on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you use to listen to us. We appreciate it when you do that. If you haven't done it yet, please leave us a 5-star review right now.
If Then is a production of Slate and Future Tense, a partnership between Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. Our producer is Max Jacobs.
Thanks to Alberto Hernandez for engineering here in lovely Berkeley, California.
And thanks to Nick Holmes at Occupy Studios in Newark, Delaware, where it is the worst possible weather today, 35 and raining. We will see you next week.
Hang in there. Bye, everybody.